Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is an historian and public intellectual. He was born and raised in The Hague to a Dutch father and a British Jewish mother. He studied Chinese literature in Holland and Japanese film in Tokyo. He spent many years in Asia, which he's also written about in God's Dust, A Japanese Mirror and Behind the Mask. He's also written Playing the Game, The Wages of Guilt, Anglomania and Year Zero. He's a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Institute for the Humanities in Washington, D.C., and he's the Luce Professor of Democracy, Human Rights and Journalism at Bard College, New York. Ian Baruma, you've written this wonderful book. It's based on the letters between your grandparents, an assimilated Jewish couple living in England. The book spans their first meeting as teenagers in 1915. It goes all the way through to 1945, encompassing the growth of their family, two world wars, the separation they endured, and the deep and abiding love for each other, their family and their country. Their correspondence is at the heart of the work, which raises profound points about class, culture, nationality, love and religion. And I'd like to start really talking about their background.
Well, they, of course, they didn't just live in England. They were born here. So they were British. But their parents, three of their parents, one great-grandmother was born in Manchester, but the other three were all from Germany. And my two great-grandfathers had come to this country to take jobs in the city in the 1880s. And they were very much part of a certain Hampstead milieu of mostly German Jews who all spoke English to one another, even though some of them were still nostalgic for Germany, and wanted to be very English. And I think it was in many ways, a successful form of assimilation more than integration. But certain elements of their German-Jewish backgrounds, I think, persisted. One was a kind of cult of classical music, which in Germany had already been the mark of being a civilized person and an educated person and of a certain upper middle class, and that carried on in Britain. And oddly enough, the center of this cult in our family and in other Jewish families was Richard Wagner, who was, of course, a ferocious anti-Semite. That and a cult of family. And I think the family, and Jews are not unique in this, but I think all people with a history of persecution tend to set great store by family because it's a kind of protection.
And it was, of course, a family musical occasion that brought them together.
It was. I think social life probably in those days was very largely a family affair. And I think they had Sunday afternoons where they would get together and have tea and cakes and so on and play music. And my grandmother was a very good violinist. My grandfather played the cello very badly. But he was very cheerful and appeared with a great grin. And according to our grandmother, she fell in love with him instantly, and she was a very different type. She was rather depressive and more pessimistic.
Mm. Music was also an indication of class, which was very important at that time.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the sort of history of German Jews, which, as I said, persisted in England, which started really with the so-called Jewish Enlightenment in the 18th century, but they became great carriers of their national culture. So German literature, too, was the great literary critics were often Jews in Germany. But music being abstract, I think, lent itself very much to this kind of identity. And, of course, it was central to the way Germans thought of themselves and their own culture. And 19th century romantic German music was considered to be the pinnacle of culture in Germany. And I think that was very much taken on by German Jews and carried on when they lived or were born elsewhere.
Mm. The book also gives us a really fascinating insight into the changing role of women, particularly after the Great War. And there are a lot of correspondence about whether or not Wynne should go to Oxford and whether she's needed at home and so on.
Yes. I think the Second World War was the same thing. Of course, with all the horrors that they involve, have certain results that are positive. They upset the social order. Wars also mean that women often take on jobs that before that were exclusively taken up by men. So my grandmother, for example, volunteered as a nurse and worked during the war. And so that had an emancipatory effect. And so after the war, I think a lot of women felt, well, why should they go back to their old subservient roles? And, they should study and so on and so forth and vote, which, of course, came a bit later. And so my grandmother studied German literature at Oxford.
It was a huge struggle for her, though, wasn't it? Internally, beforehand, she didn't know really whether she should go or not.
Yes, and I think she felt that she should take care of her parents and all that, but I think she was pining to do it, and she was very bright, and so she was, of course, absolutely right to do it.
Mm-hmm. It's also a great snapshot of life as it was in Hampstead, an area that I know well. So particularly for me, going through those streets with you and them as my guide. I mean, George Bernard Shaw sitting at the Everyman laughing at his own jokes in Pygmalion.
Yes.
Just wonderful.
And it was probably before you had all these Central European cafes on Finchley Road, which now have largely disappeared. But I remember them still in the 80s, sort of Hungarian patisseries and Viennese coffee shops. And that, of course, came with the refugees in the 30s. But again, class is so central to this whole subject. And as is true of all European cities, and no doubt this will be replicated with minorities, Muslims and others in our own time, where people lived was very much a question of class. So if you came from Eastern Europe and you were poor, you were in Whitechapel. If you did a bit better, you'd move up to Golders Green. If you did better than that, you'd end up in Hampstead or start off in Hampstead like Sigmund Freud. But so, yes, and those were very distinct groups, really, even though they were all Jewish.
Mm. In fact, you quote your grandfather who writes about not wanting, this is much later in the book, about not wanting to share with a man called Cohen because he was very Cohen-y. That was a class thing, really, wasn't
it?
It
was a class thing, I think. Even though he wasn't really a snob at all, but I mean, to put it in context, this was a letter when he was billeted in Great Missenden in 1915, chomping at the bit to be sent to the front, worrying that his German name might be a hindrance, not knowing he was going to be a stretcher bearer on the Somme, which would have been one of the most horrific experiences of the 20th century. But he had hoped that an old schoolmate of his would be billeted with him, and he said, instead, I got this fellow Cohen who was a bit Cohen-y. And that does suggest he was probably from Whitechapel rather than Hampstead.
Mm. Anti-Semitism, though, of course, is a theme. It's inescapable. Interesting the word they use for Jew, 45.
Yes. Well, 45 was a family expression, and so, you know, we would say things like, is he 45, or so-and-so looks very 45, and so on. It was family code. Now, why that started, how it started, what it really means, I've no idea. All I know is that I did get an email after my book came out in the US from somebody in New Hampshire, I think, who said her father, who is 90, suddenly burst out laughing when he was reading it. And he was an Italian Jew originally and said in his family they'd used 45 as well. So maybe it's not unique to our family, but I still don't know what the origins are.
Mm. Anti-Semitism, of course, affected your grandfather's career. He got rejected from many of the hospitals in which he'd wanted to work.
Well, hospitals in those days could be quite snobbish and clearly had discriminatory practices. And it was never put so crudely as to say, we won't have Jewish interns or doctors. It was usually the patients might feel a little uncomfortable with someone a little too foreign. And so in this case, even though my grandparents very rarely complained about anti-Semitism, they felt much too proud and much too patriotic. So they looked the other way, they knew how to dodge it and so on. But in this case, it was inescapable. And he was desperately looking for a job in a hospital, and he was turned down at St. Thomas's. And in his letter, he says, in 1938, he says, it's the old, old story, the job isn't mine for any price. And that galvanized him into organizing the rescue of 12 Jewish children from Berlin in the so-called Kindertransport.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was before the Kindertransport really started
yes.
going. I mean, he was before his time in that.
Yes.
How did he go about choosing the children? Because I think, again, that comes back to this question of class.
Well, there was a committee in Berlin set up by German Jews trying to get children out of the country. And I think he worked with them, and he made, if he was going to take care of them, and that my grandparents did for the rest of their lives, they kept up with them and so on and treated them as stepchildren. But they wanted them to fit in with one another and in the society that my grandparents knew. And so largely they came from relatively secular families, middle-class families, and so on. So there was one boy who called Michael Maibaum who was Orthodox. And my grandfather was a little worried that he would feel awkward or left out, but he was included. But he was the only one. And the rest were from families very much like ours, I suspect.
You say in the book that cultural neutrality is impossible for children of mixed heritage or the descendants of immigrants. And they totally embraced their Englishness, didn't they?
Yes, I think things have changed a bit. When I grew up in Holland, in The Hague, in the 50s and 60s, it was still relatively unusual to have parents from different cultures or different countries, as I did. My father was Dutch. But I think now, in any major European city, it's really become the norm. I mean, to have two parents from the same country has now become relatively unusual. Mm. In their day, I think you really did have to plump. If you wanted to be regarded as completely British, and they wanted to be regarded as such, you had to go the whole hog. Nowadays, of course, you can be all kinds of things and mix them up and so on, so that we have far more freedom.
Where do you feel you belong?
Oh, it depends on where I am and whom I'm talking to and so on. It's a mixture, really. I mean, here and there.
Yeah, you don't have any sort of strong visceral sense of your country.
No, but I have a stronger sense about Britain and Holland than I would about other countries. And since I write in English, and since I always felt very close to my maternal family, I suppose culturally I feel slightly more at home here than I do in Holland now. I haven't lived there for a long time.
Religion, apart from anti-Semitism, a very strong strand in the book. Your grandmother writes the wonderful line, "God is a natural instinct born into every human being." Tell me about their faith. I mean, they weren't practicing.
No. Well, what is interesting is that my grandmother, I think, always felt more socially ill at ease about her background than my grandfather. And my grandfather was the one who actually grew up in an Orthodox household. His father was Orthodox. There was nothing Orthodox about him when I knew him, but at least he knew what it was. My grandmother grew up in a completely secular family. She had very little idea of Judaism, even though they did go to the liberal Jewish synagogue more later in life when they were quite old. Her knowledge was very sketchy, and she didn't really have religious faith at all. He had a certain spiritual sense. So I think for her it was harder because she knew that she was not mainstream, that she, in many people's eyes, she was slightly different and so on, but couldn't really define what that difference was, whereas at least he could.
Life was very hard for her, wasn't it? I mean, for about 3 years they were separated and she had to look after all of these children, not only her own, but these foster children
yes.
too.
No, and she was heroic in that way. And the letters are interesting because talking to my aunt, who's still alive, the only one of her generation, and to some of the former so-called hostel children with whom I've also kept up, she never showed this. She was always very, very strong and maternal and dependable and so on. But in the letters, she does show how hard it was and how lonely she was. And they would write letters to each other sometimes every day when he was in India and she was in Berkshire, knowing that the letter wouldn't get to the other side for at least a month. And all her doubts and anxieties come out. And so reading all that for me was fascinating.
And handling the letters and finding a lock of her hair must have been enormously affecting as a grandson. And yet, of course, you're also an historian. So how do you reconcile the two?
Well, I think you're both. I think it would be much harder if they'd been my parents. I think reading intimate details of one's parents' lives and thoughts and feelings is potentially much more embarrassing. Even though I was close to my grandparents and they only died in the 1980s, there's that much more distance. Mm. And so you can be a bit more dispassionate.
Their own children, your mother and her siblings, are of course discussed in the letters. Their eldest son, John, was initially a great disappointment to them.
Yes, even though he turned out to be a world-famous film director, John Schlesinger, and had a typical childhood of an artistically inclined boy who also happened to be homosexual. And so he hated public school, and all he wanted to do was put on plays with the family, and he took all that terribly seriously. And my grandparents were very worried that he would come to nothing, and he wasn't interested in anything except putting on plays. So they were deeply worried. On the other hand, they were, in the end, very understanding and realized that he did have a great gift, worried that any artistic profession is, of course, very precarious. But yes, when he grew up, he was considered to be a washout.
You wrote a book, in fact, with him, a book of interviews.
I did.
How do you think that background in that family affected his future work? Do we see it come through?
I think it affected him a great deal. First of all, he was very much a family man, and that shows in, I think, his best film, Sunday Bloody Sunday, which is about a Jewish doctor, played by Peter Finch, but it's quite autobiographical, and the character is very close to his family, takes family seriously, and so on. So he was very family-oriented. But I think the part of, again, their milieu was that it encourage the arts, not just music. And so he grew up very well grounded in literature and theatre and so on, which my grandparents certainly did everything to encourage. Mm. So it gave him a very rich background for somebody who was going to be an artist.
What about the rest of the children?
Well, one became a publisher, one was a violinist. My mother was also considered to be a bit of a washout, even though she was a very good cellist. And interestingly enough, often in these marriages that are very, very close, where the husband and wife are so wrapped up in each other that it almost excludes, to some extent, even the children, it's a very high barrier to live up to, or barrier is not quite the word. It's very difficult to, it's a sort of model you can't possibly emulate. So in one way or another, I think all the children had problems with this. And my mother was the only one who was happily married. Alas, she died young of cancer when she was 43. But one aunt, the cellist, converted to Catholicism. She was always a great seeker and is now in the Opus Dei. One uncle was the film director, another became a publisher, and the youngest, my Aunt Susan, was an actress in the Royal Shakespeare Company and committed suicide. So it wasn't an entirely happy story. Mm-hmm. And it'd be slightly sort of pop psychology to say that it had anything to do with the extraordinary closeness of my grandparents' marriage, but it's probably not entirely unrelated.
Did you get a sense of what the children thought of the parents?
Well, I think it was a very loving family. But inevitably, I mean, we all know about Oedipus and all that. I think probably there was, with my Uncle John, the eldest son, who there was an element probably of jealousy, conscious or unconscious, of his father. And I think they all found my grandfather easier to get on with than my grandmother, who could be a bit severe and critical. But on the surface, at least, it was an extremely close and loving family.
How have the family reacted to the letters being made public?
Well, only one of my mother's generation is still alive, which is my Catholic aunt, and she's been extraordinarily understanding and broad-minded about it, because these things can go very wrong in terms of human relations. And I don't think she found it entirely easy, but she's been extraordinarily supportive. Only one of the people involved, a relative called Dick Levy, who was a refugee from Germany and lived with the family during the war, although very friendly and warm and supportive too, but had doubts about publishing the letters at all. He thought this is not what they would have wanted. They would have been horrified to see their private thoughts in public. And he's probably right. Mm. But they're no longer here. The earliest letters go back 100 years now, more, and it is history. But yeah, I haven't had great tensions with anybody over it.
We talked earlier about England, and of course you wrote the wonderful book Anglomania, A European Love Affair. And we're having this conversation before Britain votes in a referendum whether to stay in Europe or not. And I wondered what your thoughts were.
Well, I think it's... I'm very worried, because it seems to me, and this is not an original opinion, but I think Britain now has the best of all worlds, because it's in the EU, it has a say over what happens in Europe, and at the same time it can opt out of things it doesn't want. Whereas outside the EU, it'll still have to conform to a lot of rules inside the European Union without having any say. So you can listen to your Elgar records and say Britain is great, but I think it will be a very bad situation.
And migrants making the same journey that your great-great-grandparents made, it's entirely different for them now.
You mean European people who come here? Well, I don't know. I mean, yes, it is, of course, a very different experience. But one of the unintended results, I think, of Britain being in the EU is that every time I come back to London, it strikes me more and more. London has become the informal capital of Europe. This is where all the young French people want to be, and Spaniards and so on. And not just because it's cool, but because, you know, you can get jobs and all that. And you can't go to a restaurant or a pub without one of the waiters or waitresses, most of them, being from some part of Europe or elsewhere. Mm. So it has become unbelievably cosmopolitan. And whether that won't disappear if Britain leaves the EU, but I think the relationship with Europe will change. Mm.
You, of course, are based in New York, but you are on the board of an organisation that looks at human rights in China.
Yes, and I study Chinese at university, and I am interested in what goes on in China. And so I am part of that, but I'm a terrible board member, and I'm hopeless at committee meetings and so on. So it's more my name than myself that is active in this.
So we're seeing China changing rapidly now, and on the outside it seems as if it's pursuing a policy of being much, much more open. But with the internet, foreign ownership of internet companies and that sort of thing all happening now, there seems to be a confusion.
Well, the Chinese, unlike the former Soviet Union, have come up with a formula that's, or the Chinese Communist Party, I should say, which is very clever, which has been strengthened really after the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, which, of course, was a massacre that didn't just take place on Tiananmen Square, but all over China, which is to strike a deal with the educated classes living in the big urban centers, the kind of people whose children were the students on Tiananmen. And the deal is that they can have a lot of individual freedom. You can choose who you want to marry, you can choose your job, you can go on holidays, you can have sex in many different ways. The party has relinquished its control over private lives to a great extent compared to the past. But nothing organized is allowed without party control. And that makes it very, very difficult to dislodge the Communist Party from having a monopoly on power. And that'll work as long as the middle class or the educated class feels that they're getting richer and richer. But if in case of a severe economic crisis, I think you could have big problems.
Finally, we're having this conversation on the eve of Super Tuesday. In a recent essay, you argue that liberal democracy can't be reduced to a popularity contest. What do you think would be the best possible outcome for America?
Well, I'm not a huge fan of Hillary Clinton, but I think that is the best possible outcome because I think she would be fine as president. I think any of the Republicans now in contention would be a disaster, not just Donald Trump. Ted Cruz would be equally awful. And so I don't have a great deal of sympathy for the Sanders supporters because I think he's not going to be president and she could probably would be. And so if I were an American, which I'm not, I would definitely support her.
And the system in which they're chosen, is that still workable today?
Well, there's too much money involved. And too few people with immense wealth have far too much influence now on politics in America. But to come back to your earlier question, I'm against referendums in general because we elect politicians to decide on matters that are too complicated for most citizens to study very deeply. And that's the way it should be. But we don't. I think the distrust now of politicians is so deep that the people have to speak all the time. But the people cannot speak on a lot of things. I mean, for example, in my native country, there's now a movement to have a referendum on the Dutch policy on the Ukraine, which is insane because what does the average citizen know about, you know, the Ukraine? And so those sort of things should not be left up to referendums, but it's yet another symptom of the deep distrust of the political elites that are all over the world. And the danger is that it could become a distrust of democracy itself.
Ian Buruma, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War, is published by Atlantic Books. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Sam Impey and Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.